from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and coast to coast and around the globe. Radio Sputnik, where we are heard 5 days a week. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Brad Friedman. I'm your friendly progressive blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Officials in Belgium have now declared 3 days of mourning following multiple terror attacks on Tuesday at both the Brussels airport and the city's metro station that killed dozens and injured hundreds. The explosion of 3 bombs, 2 at the airport and 1 in the train station, have so far resulted in the deaths of 34 and the injuries of 214. The death toll is most likely to rise in the coming hours and the coming days. The apparently coordinated attacks come just days after the capture of Salah Abdeslam on Friday in Brussels, in connection with the terrorist attacks in Paris last November. The Islamic State, or ISIS, or Daesh, whatever you want to call them, has claimed responsibility for both the Paris attack last November, of course, and the horrific bloodshed in Brussels that is still unfolding from Tuesday. At least one of the explosions at the airport at around 8 a.m. Brussels time appears to have been set off by a suicide bomber, according to officials. About an hour later, after those first explosions at the airport around 8 a.m., about an hour later, just after 9 a.m. at the height of the morning rush hour, another blast shook the Malbeek subway station in downtown Brussels. That station is located near many European Union buildings, including the European Parliament. A third device was found unexploded and said to have been safely disarmed and removed from the evacuated airport a few hours later after those initial blasts. CBS is reporting that several Americans are among the casualties of the attacks. Mormon church officials say 3 missionaries from Utah were seriously injured in Utah. In any event, in a statement, the U.S. Department of Defense also said that 1 U.S. service member and his family were caught up in this tragedy, but due to privacy concerns right now, they are not releasing the status of their injuries at this time. The Defense Department and U.S. Embassy officials tell CBS News that they expect the number of American casualties in Brussels will go higher, as there are many Americans who work in Brussels, particularly in the area around the European Union and so forth. All of that got me thinking, as all of this was unfolding, about what Michael Ware, longtime war correspondent, had to say over the weekend. He's releasing a new film called Only the Dead, based on his hundreds of hours of footage during his years in Iraq. He spent years covering that horrific war in Iraq, the price of which it appears we still continue to pay. He was on HBO's Real Time over the weekend. He raised a few points that came to my mind immediately when I started hearing about this Brussels attacks, these Brussels attacks on Tuesday. Desi Doyen, you're here with me as well today.
Yes,
I want to say hello.
Hi.
Some of these clips from Michael Ware, you know, it's just remarkable, the juxtaposition of seeing these things play out, you know, these horrible attacks by ISIS at the same time that the presidential campaign is going on. And as we hear, you know, guys like, well, the front runner, Donald Trump, talking about, oh, we must close our borders. We'll get to that. You know, he's wanted to keep out all Muslims out of the U.S., period. Now he's talking about closing our borders to everyone.
Yeah, the first response seems to be panic.
Yes. Yeah, we're good at that, aren't we?
Yeah.
And, you know, we panicked after 9/11, and a lot of people went along with the Iraq war because they were so frightened. And, you know, it's one of the things I talk about when people say, oh, don't worry about Donald Trump. He's a clown. It'll be the best thing to ever happen to the Democratic Party. No, something like this happens. And people panic, and people get frightened, and people get scared, and people do stupid stuff that we end up paying the price for, not just in the short term in an election, but decades down the road. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Michael Ware on HBO on Real Time over the weekend. Well, let me just play a couple of these clips as he was talking about his film, talking about some of the things in his film, talking about some of the things that he saw in his many years as a war correspondent in Iraq, and how that war, that horrible mistake of a war, it's not even right to call it a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. It was on purpose. That horrible decision to go to war based on all manner of lies that had nothing to do with 9/11, that had much to do with panic, not the people who made the decision, but certainly the people who supported the decision, who are, you know, quite willing to, you know, support a leader when they come out and they say, this is what we need to do. We can't afford another 9/11. We can't afford, who knows if Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. And of course, we know he does. But even if he doesn't, who can afford to take that chance? Well, those are decisions that we pay the price for a very, very long time. And we are still paying that price today. Michael Ware talks about how every time we killed anyone, whether they were a terrorist, an insurgent, or anyone else in Iraq, how, you know, every person that we killed, every one that we killed, would create three more who wanted to kill us.
For every one person we killed or captured, we actually created two or three,
of course,
new or more insurgents. I mean, we were almost in a no-win situation. And the incident you're talking about, there's two kids, two brothers, one's like 17 and one's like 15. They were driving through our neighbourhood where Time magazine lived to get the family's monthly food ration. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that there was an American raid going on hunting for Saddam that obviously didn't find him, and some nervous GI lights up their car. And so this 15-year-old watches his 17-year-old brother's brains blown all over him.
That's Michael Ware talking over the weekend on HBO with Bill Maher about his new film based on his time in Iraq called Only the Dead. He said that older brother, he happened to witness this incident or the aftermath of it. He said the older brother was just screaming over his little brother who had been killed by these Americans, screaming, America, you will pay, you will pay. That was the beginning of ISIS. That was that insurgency, those supporters of Saddam that we threw out during that war, that horrible war in Iraq built on lies. That is who we are now facing. The world is now facing in Europe, in this country. Here's Michael Ware again talking about exactly that and as he saw it happening. In real time, if you will, and talking about it on real time over this past weekend.
You know what it reminded me of was Apocalypse Now. The way you talk about Zarqawi, who is the guy who, as you say accurately, hijacked the insurgency. And the insurgency wasn't really a religious war.
It had nothing to do
right.
with religion.
But he hijacked this, and this is the forebearer of ISIS.
This is ISIS. Let's not forget. The darkest legacy of our invasion of Iraq is that, unwittingly, we unleashed the Islamic State upon ourselves.
Of course.
And upon the rest of the world. And that's just a fact.
Yeah, that is just a fact. It's a fact that is not talked about very much. It's not talked about, you know, I need to give credit to Donald Trump here to some extent, because at least he says what we did in Iraq was a horrible mistake. He did not say it at the time. He now likes to pretend he was against the war from the beginning, but he wasn't. But most of the Republican Party, Ted Cruz and the others, you know, they don't think Iraq was a mistake. They think we should go back. Even Donald Trump has talked about sending 20 or 30,000 troops back to Iraq. And yet it was Iraq that created ISIS. It was the Iraq war that created ISIS. The Iraq war back in 2003, we went into Iraq, and here we are, 13 years later. 13 years later. still paying the price and not connecting those dots. It's so rare, you know, that you hear everyone goes into a panic, wall-to-wall coverage on CNN, on Fox, certainly on MSNBC, and they don't connect the dots. We are paying an extraordinary high price for those terrible decisions that were made in 2003, not just by the George W. Bush administration, but by those folks who supported what the George W. Bush administration was doing. You heard Michael Ware there talking about how 3 million of our children have faced that horror, have fought in those wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Actually, I'm not even sure when he cites that 3 million number. Was he talking about Iraq specifically or Afghanistan? Do you recall?
I'm not sure. He didn't specify, but it's probably a combination.
Nonetheless, yeah. Well, here he is talking about the souls of our children and the price that they paid just fighting in that war, never mind everything that has gone on since.
I know what all of this saber rattling and all of this adventurism shaves away from the souls of your children. I've seen it, man. If our film serves nothing else, it's not just to remind you all of that. Because, you know, you've been told, but there's no way you can know. And you'll see what it took from your children, from your Marines, from your soldiers. Because it's more than the physical. It's about that place in the head and the heart that you have to go to. And almost 3 million of your children have experienced something like this.
So that was Michael Ware talking again about his film. I haven't seen it, so I can't, I can't tell you one way or another. But, I was just reminded of it as soon as I saw, what was going on in Brussels. The choices that we make now, that many are making today at the ballot box around the country. Have an effect long into the future. The decisions made in 2000, back in 2000, when George W. Bush was allowed to become president, when he was selected by the U.S. Supreme Court, and much of the country just sat idly by and watched. The choice, when that happened, that was a choice, that was a decision, that was a mandate from the court to stop counting the paper ballots that we could have counted in the state of Florida back in 2000, that directly leads to what happened today in Brussels. Those choices from years ago, we are still paying for. We are still paying the price for that now in 2016. We are paying the price for that in our election with our candidates, with our blood, with our treasure. And yes, that choice to go to war in Iraq and destabilize the Middle East at the time, for at least another generation now. We're already 16 years. We're already a generation beyond what happened in Iraq in 2003. And this fight shows no time of no hint of ending anytime soon. So that choice, we are paying that for at least another generation hereafter. And it was a choice supported by all of the candidates on the Republican side right now, including Donald Trump, but also including Ted Cruz, also including John Kasich. And on the Democratic side, it was also supported by Hillary Clinton, who years later now has said that choice was a mistake. But she did make that choice to go along with George W. Bush. She did make that choice to put us into that war 16 years ago, 13 years ago, I guess. I can't do math. 13 years ago that we are now still continuing to pay an unspeakable price for. Among those now running to be our next president in these United States from the major two parties in any event, only Bernie Sanders voted against that war at the time, warning that what we are now seeing happen is what would happen. Indeed, that has happened. And he warned about it at the time. Now, you may or may not feel that's a reason to vote for or against any of these candidates. Maybe you're, Hillary Clinton has said she made a mistake. She has apologized. She says she's learned a lesson from it. Maybe you accept that. But the fact is, that was her position at the time. That was the judgment she made. That was the judgment that many people turn to now and say, well, you know, we think Hillary Clinton has the best judgment in these matters. She has the most experience with foreign policy and everything else. Okay, maybe. But that was her position at the time. She sent us into that war, which brought us to this day. And as I mentioned, even now, while he pretends to have been against the Iraq War, Donald Trump, who was not against it at the time, he is now calling for, frankly, allowing the terrorists to win, essentially, by closing the American borders to all at this point. To all. I'm not even sure how this would work. Here was Donald Trump, of course, given a microphone by Fox and Friends first thing today as the Brussels attacks were still unfolding.
I would close up our borders to people until we figure out what is going on. And we have to be smart in the United States. And when people come in, I mean, you know, we don't know where they're from, who they are. You look at them and look at it from any standpoint. They could be ISIS. They could be ISIS related. They're coming into our country. They're coming in by the thousands. And just watch what happens. I'm a pretty good prognosticator. Just watch what happens over the years. It won't be pretty. In my opinion, this is just the beginning. It will get worse and worse because we are lax and we are foolish. We are foolish. We can't allow these people. At this point, we cannot allow these people to come into the country.
So close the borders. Close the borders to everyone. I don't know who that, you know, I don't know how we continue to run this country when we start closing the borders to everyone. That means what? Americans who are abroad can't even get back? Or is it only to Muslims that we close the border? So any Muslims who are American citizens, you know, or who are otherwise allowed to be here, if they want to come back, if they want to come back home, they can't come in either. Just close the borders. Everyone traveling, business people traveling across the country, don't let them back in. Is that the plan? Is that your plan, Mr. Trump? He says, we don't know who they are. They're coming in by the thousands. Well, we know who they are. We know who is coming into our country. You know, and if he's talking about the refugees from war-torn Syria, we know who they are, too, because they don't come here unless they've gone through already an 18 to 24-month vetting process. He loves to say they're not vetted. They come in. There's no paperwork. That's just a complete and utter nonsense. But he is the front runner for the Republican Party nomination, and as I have warned many times, if there are more such attacks like this, especially closer to the election, those people who are laughing at Donald Trump right now may not be laughing, may be turning to him. Watch what happens, Donald Trump says. It will get worse, as if he was rooting for it. Yeah, elections matter. Elections matter. And I'm tired of hearing people say, oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, my candidate didn't win. I'm not going to vote for. If Bernie doesn't win, I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. I'm not going to vote at all. Okay. That is your choice. And I will fight for that to remain your choice. Your vote to not be heard at all. Your vote to pretend you are somehow boycotting and boil. That'll teach them a lesson. You know, so it's up to you. But elections do matter. Don't tell me that they don't. Don't tell me that that election in 2000 that was given to George Bush, that was stolen on his behalf by the Supreme Court. Don't tell me that didn't matter. It does matter. It did matter. It does matter. It still matters now. And as voters head to the primary polls over the weekend, there's going to be more caucuses in Hawaii and Alaska and Washington State. As that happens, we are still unraveling on this program what happened during last week's primaries in a number of states, as most people are just looking at the horse race and they are not looking at the track conditions on which those horses run and the track conditions, which mean everything. You know, it ultimately didn't matter how the people of Florida wanted to vote in 2000. It was left to the Supreme Court. So the track conditions on which they are running, the ability for people to vote, the ability for people to vote at all, to have their vote counted, to have their vote counted accurately in a way they know that it can be counted accurately, that continues to remain important. And we are continuing to look at that, all of that and more straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik.
Ah!
Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. As I mentioned previously, we are still continuing to look at what happened last week, and we will have results on Arizona, Idaho, and Utah on our next thrilling broadcast, no doubt, but we're still looking and still trying to figure out what the hell happened in Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida last week. We have been talking for the past several days about the thousands of voters who were turned away from the polls in one Illinois County alone, where they have estimated some 3,400, and that's just an estimate, 3,400 voters were unable to cast a vote because they ran out of paper ballots. The election, the county clerk there in Adams County, Chuck Van Vertlo, lowballed the number of ballots that would be needed in that county. This is Quincy, Illinois, for those people who know the state. Adams County State's Attorney John Barnard, who was our guest on the show a few days ago, had went to court the following day and got a county judge to approve what would have been, or what will still be if it comes to fruition, an unprecedented plan to deal with the problems of the ballot shortages. And I've talked about already last couple of days how I've spoken with the county clerk there, who is fairly new, who didn't know, who, you know, I don't think there was anything nefarious that happened here. But the idea that they didn't just print paper ballots, photocopy paper ballots then and there at the community centers and churches where the election was held is almost inexplicable. But for the fact that Chuck Van Vertlo tells me he's new, he had no instructions. Nobody was there to help him do this in the past. This is a problem that he has not run into in the past. In any event, the county clerk said, yeah, here's what we will do. We'll take State Attorney John Barnard's Adams County State's Attorney John Barnard's idea and open the polls for an additional week, even though the election has already happened, for an additional week for those people who were not able to vote because of this government failure to supply enough paper ballots. And the state went then and appealed that ruling by that county judge. So this week we were supposed to see voting in Adams County in what would have been an unprecedented, late extended voting after an election, after results had already been announced. John Barnard told me that, look, it's an imperfect plan, but we need to do something. We need to try to make this up to those voters who tried to cast their vote. And God love him for saying so. And God love him for coming up with the idea and taking it to court and suing and actually winning, making his case before that county judge. But then the state attorney general went in and challenged the ruling, appealed it. The county judge said no. This plan is going to move forward. That happened late Friday, just after we spoke with John Barnard on the show. Then the state AG immediately went up to a higher court, to the Fourth District Appellate Court, and got them to stop the extended voting from happening this week. The attorney general made the case that this would set a precedent, that there would be all kinds of problems that could occur in other counties where they would want to do a similar thing based on any number of problems. And so now, just a quick update that Adams County State's Attorney John Barnard has filed a response to that successful appeal by the state. He is still arguing that voters should be allowed to do this, that they would keep the ballots separated in case the ballots that were cast during this extended period, that they would keep them separated in the event that a higher court somehow determined that this was an illegitimate way to move forward. So that's sort of where we are now. He plans to file an appeal. But if he said that if the appellate court does not reverse its stay, then he does not expect to go appeal it to the Illinois Supreme Court, because the Adams County clerk must certify the results by March 29 for that March 15 election. He said, by the time you can mount a similar challenge in the Illinois Supreme Court, you will have lost critical time. Not only are days critical here, but hours are critical here for to certify that vote by March 29. So he's still fighting, but it's not looking good.
As far as all of those voters, some 3,400 in Adams County alone who were unable to vote, who wanted to vote, who many of them waited in line for hours but were not allowed to vote. That's the bad news on that story. Here's a bit of good news that now is confirmed by the Herald Whig in Quincy. As I mentioned, I had been speaking with the Adams County clerk, Chuck Van Vertlo. There were about 1,162 photocopied ballots that were sent out for people to vote on Election Day on March 15. That was not nearly enough to cover all the people who needed to vote, but there weren't paper ballots made available. But right after the election, he said that, well, we're going to take those 1,162 ballots and remake them onto actual official ballots so that they can be scanned in the scanner. They're actually going to remake those ballots. And I kind of raised some hell about it and asked, why the hell is he doing that instead of simply hand counting them, instead of remaking them and taking the risk? And frankly, the offensive move of, you know, rewriting someone's ballot. I put him in touch with an election clerk from Columbia County, New York, who explained exactly how they hand count ballots, because they hand count all ballots in this particular county. Virginia Martin is her name. And Van Vertlo told me he was thinking about it. He was considering doing that hand count, as I suggested. Herald Whig confirms that, in fact, Adams County Clerk Chuck Van Vertlo has said that if the court allows for late voting, his office is ready to go with ballots, and they have 15,000 sheets of ballot stock available. In the meantime, however, about half of the 1,162 uncounted ballots from the election have now been counted by hand. Yay, right?
Was that so hard?
Yay, right? The photocopied ballots are unable to be processed by the tabulating machines, the optical scanners there, the paper notes. Of those ballots, a vast majority were Republican ballots. Only 53 were cast for Democrats in this case. Van Vertlo said that two judges are reading them off, and two judges, one from each party, are marking down the count. He hopes that the results being posted on Wednesday. And that is exactly the process that Virginia Martin had explained to him. So there's some good news. Raising some hell seems to have paid off to some extent there. But problems elsewhere in Illinois plagued voters on that same day, specifically student voters. And this is something that we had talked about, again, the day after the election, where student voters were running into problems. At Wheaton College, remember Wheaton College, Desi? That's the college where that tenured professor was terminated because she dared at the end of the year show solidarity with Muslims at the time that Donald Trump was saying, you know, ban them from our country. She said they have the same God as we do. She promised to wear a hijab throughout the Christmas season
and
in solidarity.
And then she was disciplined.
And she fired is what she was for having the temerity to stand with them. Yeah, that college, that evangelical college outside of Chicago in DuPage County, Illinois, which we have been covering for years, is one of the most right-wing counties in all of Illinois. Just horribly corrupt. They actually have a guy who has been a member of the Republican Party, who has been fighting, pretending, you know, voter fraud and pushing for the machines and pushing for photo ID restrictions, that is actually on the payroll there, or used to be on the payroll in DuPage County. Just a terrible county. In any event, at Wheaton College, a lot of people were looking forward to voting, many for the first time, according to Think Progress, who covered this in great detail. But they were turned away. Many of these students were turned away, threatened, intimidated, and even threatened with arrest without a reasonable explanation. One polling location near the college campus did not allow hundreds of students to register to vote on Election Day, despite the state's new same-day registration law, because one election judge claimed that it would take too much time to register all of them.
Wow.
Others were turned away because they did not have Illinois identification, which is also in violation of the law, or because of confusion about polling places. The one poll worker threatened to arrest students who were waiting in line, in a long line, to be registered toward the end of the day. What was really frustrating to me was that it just seemed like it was honestly intentional voter suppression, said Mariah Gonzalez, a senior at Wheaton College. Gonzalez said it was particularly noteworthy that students of many political leanings were coming together for this shared goal in a town like Wheaton, which she describes as polarized and evangelical. But some students showed up at the polling location right near campus there, and election judge David Liddy would not allow them to register. Some were denied because of Illinois law requiring voters to provide proof of their physical address. But they only had documents with their P.O. boxes on them where they receive mail on the campus. Gonzalez says she saw 35 to 40 students turned away for this reason without a full explanation of the documentation that they would need in order to register, and that happened throughout the day. They were told if I'm unable to register you all today, this was this poll worker, David Liddy. If I'm unable to register you all today, first of all, I want to thank you for being interested and involved in voting. +1,000, -10,000 for waiting until the last minute to do it, he said to these students who were in line, many of them for hours. Drew Chambers, a Wheaton student from Virginia, told Think Progress that Liddy denied his attempt to register with his pay stub, a bank statement, a student ID, and a license, and said that it was sufficient under Illinois law. Liddy quickly asked me what state my license was issued in, and when I said Virginia, he promptly told me he would not register me, that I was a resident of Virginia, and to go vote there. That is not the law, I should note. That is not the law in the state of Illinois. That is not the law in all 50 states, actually, in this country, where you are allowed to vote. If you are going to school someplace, you are allowed to vote in the place that you're going to school, even if you are from out of state. Chambers said about this guy, this poll worker, he was visibly flustered. He asked me, who's telling you these things that you're allowed to vote here? You can't vote here. He said, when I said that I had researched the situation myself, heard from student groups on campus, and that it was my right to register in my home state or my college state, he replied, oh, so it's just a rumor filtering around campus? It's just gossip. Let me tell you, it's not true. Well, as it turns out, it was true. The student was right. The poll worker was wrong. Liddy told him no, he was not going to be voting in Virginia, where the presidential primary had already occurred, but Liddy shot down his effort. He said, unless you can show me an Illinois license, you aren't a resident, you can't vote, and that he couldn't register. And now I have to tell all of your friends who are just as wrong, so have a good day. This was according to this student. Hannah Geringer, a sophomore at Wheaton College from Wisconsin, also told Think Progress that Liddy denied her attempt to register on Tuesday morning because she did not have an Illinois state ID. Other students said so as well. And then finally, those people who were able to vote, who had a license, but didn't have proof of residence at the school because they received mail at the P.O. box. Well, eventually the school sent out an email to those students confirming their actual address so that they could go and vote. But when some of them returned, this was Hannah Geringer, a sophomore, when she returned to vote to the polling place on Tuesday evening with that required ID information, she was told she could not be registered because the line at that point was too long. Basically, this guy was turning people away. Now, some of them were able to go to the county headquarters, to the election commission, where they were allowed finally to vote, but many of them could not. One of the students said that she's guessing that there was nearly 200, probably over 200, just at one time that came at once to vote. And at this point, there was an hour left until the polls close. And they said, no, we can't do it. We've only got one computer here to register you. So you've got to go away. And of course, none of these voters should have been denied. They could have stayed in line for as long as they want. And this is in Illinois, where they don't even have a strict photo ID voting rule. Imagine what is going on in these other states like North Carolina, like Texas, like Wisconsin. you know, where they have these strict photo ID laws, imagine how many people and how easy it will be to turn people away, to keep people from voting at all. In North Carolina, Raw Story had a piece out on Monday about a guy who was, as they say, put through the ringer. He was forced to take essentially a spelling test in order to cast his vote in North Carolina, where he actually had the ID. He had a driver's license. Guy's name was Rudy Ravindra. He's a resident of Wilmington. He wrote about it in the Raleigh News and Observer about his experience when he went to cast his ballot during the early voting period in North Carolina. He said he gave his driver's license to the poll worker, but the poll worker, for some odd reason, kept it face down and ordered him to spell his name. His full name is Rudra Vajhala. He goes by Rudy, but it's Rudra Vajhala, and so he had to actually spell it out. He said that he told the poll worker, he's identifying him as HW, he said, "Look at my ID." And the poll worker said, "You got to spell it." He said, so he took a deep breath and he began spelling. And as he was trying to spell it, the guy was misspelling it, was using a B instead of a D. And Ravindra described it as a spelling test. He said the farce went on for a while. Each time the poll worker made a mistake, he patiently corrected it. But finally, and after also being asked for his address, Ravindra was able to vote. But while he was tempted to tell the poll worker off, he didn't want to because he was afraid that they might summon the police and haul him off, he says in his op-ed. Now, that was during early voting. Ravindra then went back to the polls with his wife. He took his wife to the polls on election day at a different location with a different poll worker who proceeded to give her exactly the same treatment that he got, keeping her ID face down, asking her to spell her name, asking her to pronounce it. And all the while, both in the early voting that he was at and in the election day voting that his wife voted at, just as before, Roster reports, white voters around them were easily able to pass right through with just a quick look at their ID cards. Those voters were not held up for some odd reason in Wilmington, North Carolina. Ravindra says, "My wife and I couldn't help feel that we were singled out. The poll workers could have simply looked at our IDs and saved a lot of time." Ravindra then later called the State Board of Education to lodge a complaint, and the director apologized and confirmed to him that poll workers only have to look at the photo ID. It was not necessary for him to have to spell out his name. He had an ID, and yet they still took the opportunity to harass him. Why? Apparently because he was brown. And this is in North Carolina, where they've just passed this this new photo ID voting restriction, along with limiting early voting days and hours, making it harder to vote, did away with voter registration for 17-year-olds who used to be able to register in advance if they were going to be 18 years old on election day. The strictest voter suppression law in the country, which was passed in North Carolina. Before that, and this was a guy who had a photo ID, and he was still harassed. Imagine the some 218,000 registered voters, already registered, legally registered voters. And remember, under federal law, when you go to register, you must show an ID. So these are 218,000 people who have already been identified in North Carolina, but who do not have the type of ID that is now required. That guy had the ID that was required. Imagine if you didn't. Well, we don't have to imagine. Ari Berman, we've been talking about this for actually years, specifically in North Carolina. Ari Berman keeps turning out new examples, fresh horror out of the state of North Carolina, including Etheline Douglas, an 85-year-old African-American woman who grew up in the segregated South. She first registered to vote in 1964. Her struggle to obtain the necessary ID vividly illustrates the problems with the law, says Berman. In September of 2012, Douglas's niece, Clara Quick, took her to the DMV in Laurinburg, North Carolina, to get a state photo ID. Remember, you're supposed to be able to get these free photo IDs if you don't have the type that is now required to vote in these states, in these Republican states where they have limited it. So she went to try to get one of these IDs, a state photo ID, in 2012. Douglas was told that that she needed a copy of her birth certificate to get that ID. So they traveled across the state line to Dillon, South Carolina, where Douglas was born, to try to find her birth certificate. Remember, she's 85 years old. But the government office in South Carolina said she needed a photo ID in order to get her birth certificate. And then she was seemingly caught in this catch-22. This is from the affidavit that the niece, Clara Quick, filed in federal court in the case that is still pending in North Carolina against this law. So the niece then called the South Carolina's vital records office, paid $17 for an expedited birth certificate, but still couldn't get one. Instead, she was told to find her aunt's marriage certificate, which was in Bennettsville, South Carolina. After getting that, they made a second trip to the North Carolina DMV, but yes, you can see this coming. Once again, they were told that Douglas couldn't get a photo ID because she didn't have a birth certificate, even though she had the marriage certificate. They were so frustrated, they gave up trying for a while. And then in the fall of 2013, after North Carolina then passed the voter ID law, they made a third trip now to the DMV. An employee told the niece to get a census report to confirm her aunt's identity. Because remember, they still couldn't get that birth certificate. So she got a census report. That cost $69. Quick brought her aunt's census report, her marriage certificate, a Social Security card, a utility bill in their fourth trip now to the DMV in September of 2014, and was finally able to get the ID, the photo ID needed to vote. Hooray. It took just 2 years, four trips to the DMV, two trips to South Carolina, and $86 in government documents for this 85-year-old woman. This is our electoral system in 2016 when, yes, voting matters. Yes, elections matter. Yes, we see, as we discussed in the previous segment about what went on in Brussels, yes, elections matter. The people we put into office matter. We need to be able to make sure people can vote. We need to be able to oversee those votes. Now, I'm getting a word of huge lines in Arizona at the primaries on Tuesday. Apparently, they condensed what had been 190 polling places to just 60 for some reason for vote. Lines are hours long in many places. Many people are being forced to cast provisional ballots. Gina E. writes to me at bradcast@bradblog.com to say, I have never in almost 20 years of voting here in Arizona seen anything like this. She considers it another form of voter suppression. And in the meantime, it's just amazing. It never stops. And you know, and I should say, I don't cover everything that I hear from people. I hear, not only do I hear from people, but I see a lot of problems out there. Problems that are, mistakes happen. Problems happen. Elections can get messy. Caucuses can certainly get messy. But errors happen. You've got volunteers working at the polling place. It only happens every couple of years. Errors can happen. I only bother to point out things that, appear to be, endemic of a larger problem. Issues that seem to suggest, that are not just one-offs, a bad thing that happened to one particular person, unless that bad thing that happened to that one particular person, suggests that we have a larger problem here. Well, guess what? We have a larger problem here. We have large problems all over the country. And as if the problems aren't bad enough, it seems like we're going out of our way to make more in Utah. In Utah. I love the way that Wired, this is Issy Lepowski, describes it. Security researchers pretty much uniformly agree that letting people vote online is a very bad idea, one that is fraught with risks and vulnerabilities that could have unknowable consequences for the future of democracy. This week, the Utah GOP is going to give it a whirl anyway. So apparently the Utah Republican Party paid more than $80,000 to a private company by the name of Smartmatic. Heard of them? Which manages electronic voting systems and internet voting systems in 25 countries. They will run the GOP caucus system. Smartmatic will. And they will do it via online voting. So I think there'll actually be in-person caucuses as well, but you have the option, if you want, to vote online. What could possibly go wrong? Well, we know what could go wrong. Computer security scientists and security experts have been warning us about this now for years. We have been talking about it on this program for years. The computer scientists have said, no, our internet is simply not secure enough to allow this. Votes can be stolen and voters may well never know that their vote was stolen. And even if it's not stolen, even if it's not hacked, even if devices, they're talking about, you know, allowing them to vote from their iPhone. So even if they're not hacked, there is actually no way to know at the end of the day. The voters cannot know whether it has been hacked or not, whether it has been recorded accurately or not. Now, because this is a private affair as a caucus, it's not being run by the state, the party can do whatever the hell they want. And they're deciding to spend $80,000. They've signed up some 59,000 Utah Republicans to vote online. And the guy who's running this, is Utah GOP Chairman James Evans, says, well, he dismisses the security vulnerabilities. He says that it would be far-fetched. It would be far-fetched that anybody would want to game this election. Really? It would be far-fetched? When he was asked about, where is this quote? I can't even find it. When he was asked about the idea of, you know, intimidate, vote buying and vote selling, because what they're going to do is you can cast your vote and then you can apparently go look at a bulletin board to see how it is the system claims that they recorded your vote. And of course, the question comes up for vote buying and selling and voter intimidation. And Evans, the guy who's running this, for the Utah GOP, when he was asked about the possibility of, you know, bribery and coercion, you know, coercing someone to vote one way or another, he said, that doesn't make any sense to me. You're saying that in my house, I elect to vote online and you come into my house and force me? So I guess what he's saying is, women who are married to, an abusive husband, they don't have to worry about it. I guess they're saying that, if you're an employee and your boss wants you to vote a specific way and wants to make you prove it, don't worry about it. That would never happen. He can't even imagine that happening. There is a tremendous lack of imagination in this country. I'm sorry. I'm running late. I got to get to a quick break. We'll be back. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to The Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to The Bradcast. I ran over all by myself. I ran late. Sorry about that. So just very quickly, let me do one reader email. This is actually a comment that came in at bradblog.com about my conversation with Kevin Drum from Mother Jones on our program yesterday. We were talking about many of the good things that were going on and how people's outrage and their fury over all manner of issues that is, you know, stoked by politicians. Really, it can be a disservice, particularly when we're dealing with important issues. And we were and one of the things that came up very quickly was Flint, Michigan, and the fact that now the lead levels are somewhat closer to, they're down from where they were, but there's a problem all over the country when it comes to lead levels. And his concern was that fighting about, being outraged about what happened in Flint means that we won't see it. We won't deal with the problems in other states. Desi Doyen, what did you say in your Green News report recently? There was
Yes, it was a USA Today analysis of EPA data, and it found that there were almost nearly 2,000 systems in the United States.
2,000 water systems,
affecting
right.
6 million people.
And so I think that was the point that that Kevin Drum was trying to make. I don't think he was trying to say, oh, there's nothing to be worried about,
right.
nothing to be outraged about at all in Flint. But that wasn't really the main point of our conversation. Flint wasn't. And yet he made those comments, and some have taken exception, including Oaktown Girl at bradblog.com, who stopped by to comment that the people of Flint had their democracy stolen out from under them and were living under emergency management rule. And this is right. The Republican governor there just essentially removed all of the elected officials, put in whoever he want by, you know, after declaring an emergency. And it was that emergency manager who flipped the water to that new source that led to corrosion of the pipes, that led to this horrific lead poisoning across Flint. They had good water until the emergency manager, Oaktown Girl writes, and his stooges decided to flip the switch, willfully ignoring all of the environmental and health warnings. But Kevin Drum thinks we shouldn't be angrier about that than about any other community that has lead problems, and you don't call them on it, Brad? That's BS. Yes, she says, we have entrenched environmental problems all over the country which desperately need to be addressed, but to dismiss that what happened to Flint as, quote, hysterical is beyond the pale. Surprised he just didn't come out and say all cities matter, in a reference to Black Lives Matter. And those who say, well, all lives matter. You know what? I think her criticism of both Kevin Drum and of me is fair. I think I should have said something about that. It wasn't really the point of our conversation, but I think that's a fair criticism. So I wanted to get that out there. Thank you for sending that in, Oaktown Girl. If you'd like to comment on anything you hear on our program, you can always email me. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can stop by the Facebooks and the Twitters and find me at The Brad Blog. All right, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download it for free, as ever, at bradblog.com or over at iTunes. Until we meet again, and I suspect we'll be covering the election results on Tuesday. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Thank you, and good luck, world.